I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about opening up adoption records. For more than 50 years, adoption records in Indiana were closed. The Indiana General Assembly is considering legislation that would allow adoptees from that era to gain access to their birth records. We'll discuss what this means and for whom. My guest will be Melissa Shelton of Hoosiers for Equal Access to Records, or HEAR. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about opening up Indiana's closed adoption records. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guest today is Melissa Shelton, who's a board member for Hoosiers for Equal Access to Records, otherwise known as HEAR. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here. Well, let's start and talk a little bit about the nature of this time period in which Indiana's adoption records were closed. It was a 50-year slice, really, from
1941 to 1993.
And, first, it sounds like there was a period when such records would not have been sealed. What prompted them to be sealed in 1941?
In general, adoption, really birth certificates, were sealed from, not necessarily from the adoptee, but from the public, because way back when, unfortunately, our birth certificates were stamped bastard or illegitimate, and mm-hmm. they didn't want us as children, going off to kindergarten with this birth certificate that was stamped that way. So what they did was they sealed the records so that the public wouldn't be able to see that. They gave us fresh birth certificates with our adoptive parents' names on them so that we could not stand out and not be stigmatized.
Boy, that sounds to me like a recipe for identity theft in today's world, too.
Right.
But, they have two sets of birth records out there,
right.
In effect, means that there's a spare identity floating around.
Right, there is.
So it stayed this way from 1941 to 1993. How were things changed in 1993?
For any adoptions that occur starting January 1st, 1994 forward, as of today, the birth certificates are still sealed. They're still given amended birth certificates with their adoptive parents' names on them. However, when they turn 21, they can go down to vital records and they can request a copy of their original birth certificate.
Okay, so what we're talking about here is sort of a window in time,
right.
that is created. What's created the impetus to open those records?
We just want to create equality for all adoptees in Indiana, just even the playing field for that 50-year span. Like you said, people are dying because they don't have information about who they are, where they came from, just overall general questions throughout their lives, really.
And how did you get involved in this quest? We're going to talk some about the legislation mm-hmm. here soon, but how did you get involved in this?
I am an adoptee. I was adopted in 1968, and then we adopted our two children. Mm-hmm. And that really sparked for me, I wanted to search for my birth family. The curiosity started just about then. And then after having done my search, I realized how difficult the process was, how expensive, how long the process takes, and I just knew things had to change.
And were you successful in your search, or were you?
I was successful in my search.
What did you find from that process? I know I'm taking us off topic, but these sort of personal stories always fascinate me.
Yes. What I found was 8 brothers and sisters.
Oh, wow.
And one of my brothers is a full biological brother. We have the same birth mother, same birth father, and but we were placed in separate homes, so we never knew about each other. We never knew
that
each other
existed. Was he older or younger?
He's 12 months, 36 hours older than me.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So we're essentially Irish twins, yeah.
Okay.
12 months apart.
Mm-hmm. And just because these stories fascinate me, mm-hmm. you know, what did you find out about your birth mother and your birth father's circumstances? I mean, it was the essential question, sort of, what prompted the decision
to place us for adoption?
Yeah.
My birth mother was quite a bit older than a statistically typical birth mother would be. She was 27 when she had me. And my birth father was 42. He was an Irish immigrant. And it was a long-term affair that created my brother and I. So, you know, back in 1960s, that was unacceptable, completely unacceptable to have a child out of wedlock, especially under those circumstances. So we were placed for adoption.
How did you feel when you found all of this stuff out?
Relieved, because it was finally I found out what the truth was, what my story was. I didn't care what the story was necessarily. I just wanted to know what it was, because if you don't know, you make stuff up.
Yeah. We are talking about opening up Indiana's closed adoption records here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we're joined now by Pam Krosky, who is the president of here. Pam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. So we should talk about what is the news hook for this. I'm going to be easily diverted because people's personal stories on this always fascinate me. But there is legislation in front of the Indiana General Assembly right now. It's a bill that has been approved by the Senate, right? Indiana Senate. Senate Bill 352. Could you tell us, Pam, what Senate Bill 352 would do?
Essentially, it will even things out. What exists right now is prior to 1941, and then after 1994, adoptees can register with the state, and then as long as there's not a non-release form on file, they will receive all of their identifying information, which includes their original birth certificate. So what we're trying to do is get between 1941 and 1993 to be equal.
And when you say a non-release form, that means if the birth parents, in effect, say they do not want this information released, even to their birth children?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so it, to some degree in legal terms, and I'm going to try to break this down, what we're really doing is shifting the burden here. The presumption is no longer that these records will be private. It is that the birth parents, specifically the birth mother, has to take an affirmative step and decide to seal them.
Yes, that is true. I think that's right now the easiest way to do it, and that's how it is for 94 forward. So it really is probably the easiest way to do this, and that way adoptees can finally get a chance to take a look at their identifying information and take a look at that elusive original birth certificate. For most of us, we see this amended one that our parents have, and it looks as though our adoptive parents actually gave birth to us. So this is a document I think most of us are the most interested in seeing.
Did the under the old system, from 1941 to 1993, was there ever, a sunset period on the restriction that if the birth mother died or, you know, a certain number of years passed, the seal was broken. I'll throw that one to Melissa because you were shaking your head at me. So.
Yes. During those 50 years, if let's say a birth parent moved to Florida and they passed away in Florida and an adoptee goes to vital records and requests to request their information, the vital records, they'll check to see if a birth parent that was listed on the birth certificate has died in the state of Indiana. Well, they're not going to look in Florida. So if your birth parent has died and you have no proof, which how could you get proof? You don't know who they are. You don't get your records.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly proving a negative. It's like chasing a ghost.
It is like chasing a ghost.
So during this period, and the argument, it sounds like, was for the restriction, ultimately, was that we wanted to spare both the children who were adopted and to some degree the parents who gave their children up to adoption, the social stigma, allow them a way to avoid the social judgments that took place during that era.
Right. Well, I actually have a copy of my birth certificate, and at the bottom it actually says legitimate. You can check a box yes or check a box no, and mine says no. So basically, I'm illegitimate.
Oh boy.
So
when did you first see that, Pam? I mean that
when I actually did the reunion process with my birth mom. And the other portion to this is, one is exactly what you're saying, having that birth certificate. In the quotation of saying sealed, as if I'm doing like air quotes, that wasn't really meant to be what happened. It was just meant to not have it be public. So there's a difference to me. Sealing it and not having it be public is because we wanted to protect these children and myself from the stigma in entering school or, whatever the case might be. And some birth certificates are actually stamped bastard.
Mm-hmm.
So where I'm marked illegitimate, to me, there's even a worse statement on there. But the other option, or not the other option, the other side of this coin is that I lost my birth mom 2 years ago to breast cancer. And I think the biggest part for this, for people is, knowing, our original identities, having this birth certificate, and then on the other side is the medical history. Because as our mothers relinquished us so many years ago, they had no idea of health issues that would come on, 30, 40, 50 years later. And so that's essential to me, is finding out as much medical history as we can possibly get.
So there's a practical effect. I guess where I was going with the question here is, what was the argument after we changed the law, effective January 1st, 1994, to keep those records from 41 to 93 under wraps?
I would love the answer to that. The legislators that chose this, it actually was done 21 years ago. So these adoptees that were infants at the time are now adults, and they, as of this January, can access their forms. Why pick that time span? And why block off some 50 years of adoptees who are actually in the throes of needing their medical history? And we are long since newborns, toddlers, infants. So, why are we being blocked? And I think that's the biggest question, to say to anyone who is thinking that it's fair as it is with the registry and et cetera, because it's not fair.
And obviously the law changed, as you say, 21 years ago, a little more than 21 years ago.
Right.
Now. How long, and you've just gotten a bill that's moved through the Indiana Senate, so you're about a third of the way through the process. You need to get the House to approve it, and then you need to get the governor to sign it. How long has it been to get you to this point? And we've got about 30 seconds left.
Pam and I have been working on this since about 2007. We actively started working on legislation in 2009 for the state. So it's been a long process just to get where we are right now.
And what were the, when you first started doing this, real quickly, what were the arguments you heard of for not doing it?
One of the biggest myths that's out there is that these were all sealed to protect birth parents and the identity of those birth parents from their children. And it's a myth because the parents were never promised confidentiality.
We are talking about opening Indiana's closed adoption records here on No Limits. My guests are Melissa Shelton and Pam Krosky of Here. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about opening Indiana's closed adoption records. My guest in studio with me is Melissa Shelton, who is a board member of HEARE. That's Hoosiers for Equal Access to Records. We're also joined on the phone now by birth mother Marcy Keithley Roth. Marcy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
Certainly. It's good to have you here. So, real quickly, when we're talking about, first, Marcy, you know, I've identified you briefly, and one of the things I dislike about this is that we have to reduce people's lives to a thumbnail here, and it boiled yours down to a single phrase, birth mother. Could you tell us a little bit about your story and about how you got interested and involved in this issue?
Certainly, and what happened with me is I relinquished in the 70s. And fast forward to 2007, by accident, I found the birth father. Several months later, we married and went on a search for our daughter, and we found her. And she had been looking for us for over a decade.
Oh, boy. Where did you find her?
Well, I went to a blog by accident, and she was a search angel. My daughter was registered on the International Sound X Registry, and she just put two and two together. And within 5 hours after my blog post, they had a match.
Oh, wow.
It was luck, pure luck.
Well,
because I was on no registry.
So yeah, it sounds like that was a stroke of fate, as it were. So when did you decide to get involved with HEARE?
When I realized what had happened to my daughter, that she had been searching me for well over a decade, and the difficulty that she experienced because of that, I started doing some self-studying on the Internet and realized that the original birth certificates were sealed and that she was never given to her when she turned 18 or 21, which was just the assumption. And the more I studied, the angrier I got. And I started connecting in the adoption community and doing some volunteer work. And I met Pam Krosky in 2010 when I was trying to organize an event in Louisville, Kentucky, to raise awareness to this. And I stuck with Pam and Melissa, and the next thing, HEARE was born.
Well, and I'd like to ask the question, because it sounds like the resistance, from what I'm hearing from Melissa and to a degree I heard from Pam a few minutes ago, is that the main argument against opening up the adoption records from that period,
correct,
was that, there was a concern about protecting the birth mother's privacy and granting her to some degree a level of anonymity. You are in a unique position in being able to speak directly to that because it mirrors your experience.
Yes, sir.
So what do you think of that argument?
First of all, there's a big difference between secrecy and privacy. There are many promises made to birth mothers, but a lifetime sentence of never knowing what happened to your child was not one of them. It goes back to the social stigma of being an unwed mother in the 70s, protecting the child. I was always of the assumption that one day she would come searching for me, and I had prepared myself for that, whether it be 18 or 21. Maybe I would receive a letter, a phone call, and when nothing happened, I assumed that her adoption was fine and she was doing well, and I respected that. Mm-hmm. But when we connected, I found out the truth. And, for instance, her medical records. I was an epileptic as a child. I had seizures. I disclosed it on the medical forms. They never gave it to the adoptive family. And as a result, my daughter began to have seizures, and she had a stroke by the time she was 22.
Oh, boy. So that is almost a cautionary tale here. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances in which you relinquished your daughter to adoption, and talk us through, because that does seem to be one of the centerpieces, what you were told at that time, what adoption would involve.
Yes, John, I was solicited by my own physician for adoption. He knew I was single, I was young, I had no money, my boyfriend had recently left me, and he kept asking me questions, what are you going to do? And he was the one that personally arranged my adoption. And I had no legal representation. There was only a notary present. I was not given copies of anything that I signed. Just a very, very dark hour in my life.
How old were you at this time?
Actually, I was 21 at the time.
So you were 21. So mm-hmm. you were, mm-hmm. to some degree, legally competent and all of that. But that's still awfully young. But it sounds almost as if your doctor was attempting to function as your legal counsel as well.
Yes, he basically took my child and gave her to a couple that he went to college with.
We've gotten a question, or more of a comment question, but it takes us into an interesting area that both of you have alluded to in regard to the medical records. And I should say, if you want to join this important conversation and you are listening, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Caller who didn't want to go on the air says that children of adoption statistically live a decade shorter because they cannot obtain their medical history due to the closed adoption process. Is that, Melissa, to the best of your knowledge, is that number accurate?
You know, I've never heard that specific statistic before, but it is such a common story to find out that someone searches and then you find devastating medical history in your background. In my specific case, one of my eight brothers and sisters, my brother was not even 50, and 2 years ago he passed away from colon cancer, and I would have never known to even be screened for that prior to 50. Who gets screened for colon cancer prior to that? And that's just one example. My son's adoption, I searched for his birth mother and found his brother, who was 3 years older than him. I found an article in the newspaper where he was getting his head shaved, and his buddies were surrounding him, getting their heads shaved in unity with him because he had a brain tumor. And that was for my son.
Oh, boy. So there is a significant practical argument for
Absolutely. This,
too, that has literally life and death.
It's life and death. It's not fear. It's life and death.
We are talking about opening adoption records here on No Limits. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been listening, and I'm a birth mother that is blessed that I do know my daughter now. But when I gave her up for adoption, it was through St. Elizabeth's Home, and they were they told me flat out that I'm not going to be able to see her, you know. It wasn't like I thought that, wow, I just got to wait a certain amount of time and then she'll be in my life. Because at one point I was you know, months after giving her up, I, you know, got panicked thinking, what if something happens to her? You know, medically, like you guys are talking about, will she need, you know, blood, you know, body parts, anything? I wanted them to know I'm available for body parts, you know. And that's when I was told, no, there's no, we will not be able to contact you for anything. So I knew that until, you know, until I did find out about the registry. And then it was like, wow, you know, a ray of light, you know, wow, maybe, you know. I feel like the registry is a really good thing because it's kind of on their terms. You know, I can put, I had my name in there, and then when my daughter found out about the registry, which maybe that's the thing, maybe the registry needs to be put more out there for people to know about, because she didn't know about it. She ran into it while looking for something for her own child, and that's how, boom, next you know, we're in each other's lives. So I just wanted to put that out there because I thought it was important.
What was it like when you found her? After
oh my God, it was, oh wow. I mean, I'll still cry about it. It was best day of my life.
Well,
I mean, you know, I mean, I couldn't tell her whole story, but you know, it took, you know, a while to get to, because you have to learn, you know, we had to learn to know each other, learn our relationship. So the start was just amazing, but then it was years and years, you know, I mean, we've known each other over 3 years now, and it's, you know, I can just pick up and call and talk to her. You know, it's great. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Well, it sounds like you went through some regret and some sadness to get to that point, but I'm very glad that you got there. Thank you for calling and sharing your story with us, Sarah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Certainly. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, we've been cued a couple of times here. We probably ought to talk about what the registry is here that they're talking about and give the URL. Melissa, I'm going to throw that one to you.
There is a registry here in Indiana. It's the Indiana Adoption History Program Registry, where a birth parent can register, an adoptee can register, and if there's a match, they will be put together. However, I'm a confidential intermediary for the state of Indiana, and it is it's touted as this great program that puts families together if they're searching for each other. But in reality, it is a broken system. It is not the end-all be-all for it's not the solution here.
How is it broken?
For example, we in the state of Indiana, we only have a handful of confidential intermediaries. Those of us that are, the majority of CIs is what we call them.
And we probably ought to define what a confidential intermediary is.
I
know you know what it means,
right,
but...
Right. A confidential intermediary is appointed through the courts to search for a birth family member, and then we approach that birth family member to see if they would like to have contact or not.
Okay. So, getting back to, in what ways is the system broken, the registry broken?
First of all, the search is the easy part. Finding is the easy part. The difficult part is making those initial phone calls. It's a very sensitive phone call to make. And in Indiana, there is no standard. There is no training set out for CIs. Essentially, anyone who wants to be a CI can be appointed by one of the county courts to be a CI. Well, I happen to be a social worker, and it pains me because I hear of situations where these untrained CIs are approaching birth parents, and it's disastrous results, emotionally disastrous, because they're not trained in how to handle it. You can have a passion for this, but that doesn't mean that this is something that you should be doing.
How do you approach someone with, you know, how do you make that first phone call or that first visit? How do you frame the conversation?
Very, very generically, so that in their mind they can kind of be brought around to the idea of who this is that's calling them and what they're calling about. So, for example, I might ask them about a date. Does this date mean anything to you? I'm looking for so-and-so. It's a very delicate situation.
Marcy, and, you know, because, well, and I guess, Melissa, you both have kind of been through different different parts of this searching process. What were the things that would have helped you along the way? I'll start with Marcy first. When you wanted to look for your daughter, what kinds of things would you have found helpful that just weren't there?
Well, we're making the assumption that everybody knows of the registry and how to utilize it, number one. Everybody has to know that it's out there. In each state, they're different. So, you know, when Melissa was speaking earlier, if all the stars are aligned, John, if the whether it's the birth parent looking for the child or the child the adoptee looking for their birth parents, I mean, if all the stars are aligned and utilizing the registry, it could work. But the problem is, it doesn't, because they're not.
So there needs to be, it sounds like, some sort of clearinghouse where the information is kept, or at least a place to go to find out where you can get more information.
Well, and I don't know.
And this
that
is a chance also, Melissa, for you to plug here's website too, if you want to.
Yes. Okay. If you're interested, you can go to www.indianahere.org.
Go ahead and give that to him again.
It is www.indianahere.org, H-E-A-R.org.
Okay.
And really, the whole basis of this is, why should there have to be a clearinghouse
exactly
to get your information? Is it your birth certificate, John? Is it Marcy's birth certificate? It's my birth certificate. And it, just because there's a birth parent name on there, that doesn't mean that the adoptee is going to go searching. They may not want any contact with anyone, but that's their record.
Now, if I understand Senate Bill 352, which is the one that's moving through right now, there still is a provision in there that would allow a birth mother to, you know, to seal the record, as it were. But she's got to make, you know, a decision to do that.
Correct.
An affirmative one. The presumption's not on on that side. Is that a satisfactory solution for you? Because to some degree, what I'm hearing you say, Melissa, is that that really your birth record's your birth record.
It is.
And, you know, once you're in the in this world, you ought to have access to it. It's just that simple.
And that's true. But I think we need to take this one step at a time. And let's just make the playing field even for all adoptees. And if a birth parent chooses to put in a non-disclosure, then that's their choice. They can put in that non-disclosure statement. But on the other hand, too, we're talking about adoptees who are 70 years old. I mean, these are 70-year-old adoptees going to, let's say, birth mom was 15, 20. That's an 85-year-old or a 90-year-old. By the time you're 70 and you're 85, you've kind of learned that life isn't so serious, and life isn't so, it doesn't have to be so dramatic, and it, many things are more important than that.
So it sounds like, and what would happen in the case of with this bill, presuming it becomes law, the birth mother is dead or incapacitated, is it then the default position is that the adoptee would has access to the birth records?
Yes, if the birth parent passed away here in Indiana. If outside of the state of Indiana, they would have to verify the death
in some fashion. So it sounds like Senate Bill 352 is a half step or a three-quarter step to
it
where
is.
You want to go
it is.
Ultimately.
Yes.
I mean, Marcy, do you think that that the birth records just across the board should be open?
Yes.
Yes.
I do. I do. I believe that, you know, my right to be shielded from the embarrassment pales in comparison to my daughter's right to her, you know, her biological identity. I mean, this birth mother privacy, you know, it should, you know, supposed, it should never supersede the right of an adoptee to his or her information. They have to have that. It belongs to them. It doesn't belong to me.
Go ahead, Marcy. We got a couple more seconds.
And one thing I think is important to understand as well is, you know, the original birth certificate isn't sealed at the time of relinquishment. Relinquishment takes away the rights, but it doesn't provide new ones to me. that nobody else had.
Marcy, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. We're talking about Indiana's closed adoption records here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about opening Indiana's closed adoption records here on No Limits today. My guests are Melissa Shelton, who is a board member for HEAR, that's Hoosiers for Equal Access to Records. And joining us by phone is Richard Erlob, who's with the American Adoption Congress. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, if you could, give us an overview real quickly. I mean, where does Indiana stack up among states that, in regard to their adoption laws?
Well, Indiana is kind of middle of the pack. Nationally, this has been an incremental battle for a number of states. States like Kansas and Alaska actually never sealed their original birth certificates from adoptees. Other states like Alabama, Oregon, Maine, New Hampshire, among a longer list of about 14 states, have fully opened access to adult adoptees. I'm based in Colorado, and Colorado is one of those states that just passed such a law last year. So Indiana is fighting the good fight, and I think it's very exciting to see the great response in the Indiana Senate.
We've gotten an email from a listener who doesn't want to be named, and if you want to reach out and join the conversation by email, you can do so by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. This email says, and it's a new wrinkle to this, is I have to mention that there are thousands of others like me who were born in the 1980s using anonymous sperm donors. In my case, my parents' infertility forced them to use IVF, an anonymous sperm donor, and my mother's OB actually told her never to tell me or anyone else, that no one ever has to know. This is outrageous to me, as I would have gone my whole life telling my doctor's false genetic history, which can have far-reaching implications. And when I was sick as a teenager, my doctor almost made a diagnosis based on my father's genetic history, which is not my own biological history. My mother told me the truth at that time, and I am grateful to her for that. I have tried many times to contact her doctor's office for information on my sperm donor, only to access medical histories, not to find his identity. But they tell me there are no records anymore because of the laws at the time. Children like me, born to anonymous donors, deserve the right to know our own medical histories, too. First, is this a common problem? Richard, I'll start with you on that one.
Yes, it's a growing problem and very troubling. PBS, and thank you to the whole public radio and public television system for covering several stories like this. I think that we are locked arm in arm with the children who were produced by donor insemination because there are some very similar issues. Many laws intended to help people become parents were very well-intentioned, but often short-sighted. I think at the time that records were sealed, one of the main purposes for sealing those records, if you look into the legislative history of most states, was to prevent a birth parent from coming back and trying to claim the child. It was not so much that secrecy was promised to birth parents as it was imposed upon them. And in the same way, with donor insemination children, I think well-intentioned people are wanting to have couples able to raise families, but they're short-sighted. People forget that these infants, these children, grow up and start having children of their own and need to know that history and need to have equal rights to access about themselves.
We are talking about opening Indiana's closed adoption records here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Denise, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I am actually an adopted mother, and wanted to hear some more conversation about the rights and considerations of people who have adopted. In my particular instance, my son was adopted out of a very dysfunctional situation, and a situation that continues to remain dysfunctional to this day. And even though we had an open adoption, I kept my end of the bargain, sent pictures of my son when he was a baby until the point where we started getting returned mail. When my son was 14, social media gave an avenue for siblings to contact my son. And it was very disruptive, I think in part because even though he knew he was adopted, we were giving him information at a level I thought he could handle. And then this sudden dropping in of information and contact through social media ended up leaving him very disturbed. It was a very, very disruptive time for my son.
How old is your son?
I want to address that.
How old is your son now, Denise?
He is currently 17, but at the time that this was kind of, this person found him on Facebook, he was only 14.
Okay. Well, I guess my context in asking that is it was after 1994. It was after...
Yes. He had a totally open adoption. And I wonder, you know, it's social media kind of takes some of those bars off, even if it were to be a closed adoption, because people start looking. And sometimes things are found out before the child is emotionally ready to handle some of these things. And we did everything the social workers and things told us to do as far as preparing him and making sure none of this was a surprise. But, you know, sometimes adoptive parents are there to protect these children from very dysfunctional situations.
Okay, I'm gonna let Melissa tackle that one first because she can speak to it from both sides of the equation. As an adopted child and an adoptive parent, you've been on both sides of that equation. Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your story, Denise.
All right, thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
And it sounds like, it sounds like Denise did the right thing. She informed her son. She did what the social workers asked her to do, and she was very open with him. We're talking about this law does not pertain to people under the age of 21. We're talking about adults. We're not talking about teenagers. We're not talking about 14-year-olds, 17-year-olds. I have a 15-year-old, and when he was 14, social media put them together. And however, he asked my permission, and I said, "Of course, absolutely." But that's something that I monitor even to this day. But this bill is focused on adults.
Yeah, by definition, since the period, it doesn't affect anyone who was born before January 1st, 1994.
Absolutely.
So by definition, everyone is 21 and legally an adult. And I should, this is probably the appropriate moment to drop this in. We got a call from your mother, Melissa, who said, just wanted to say that the day she adopted you was the best day of her life.
Uh-oh.
It's really, really sweet. We also have an email from a listener named Jennifer, and if you would like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, there is a middleman for patients of transplants where they can reach out to donor family and or donor family can reach out to them. There is no direct contact unless it's agreed upon. It seems like that would work in this situation for adoptees and birth parents to get in contact. Is that, Melissa, you're shaking your head.
I am, because that is the system that's in place right now, is with the confidential intermediary. There is a system in place, but the system is so expensive. It costs upwards of $750 for an adoptee to go to the vital records and have a confidential intermediary assigned to them by the courts, and then for the search to be conducted. It's very expensive. It takes a long time. And the CIs are not trained properly.
We are talking about opening up Indiana's adoption records, which were sealed from 1941 to 1993 here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My child was born after the 1993, but at the point that the termination suit for adoption and everything was filed, I'm the birth mother. The birth father fought it under the putative father information, and so her initial birth certificate was just issued as infant girl. Then the initial suit was ruled unconstitutional, and so that triggered a custody suit. And as a course over time, my daughter has actually had 4 birth certificates on record with the state of Indiana. And at the point that she turned 19, my husband adopted her in open court. And so through the process, we had to provide birth certificate information so that they could change it to an adoption birth certificate. And the court clerk's office had never encountered a person with multiple birth certificates before, multiple names, all that. So it was a little bit of a process that they randomly picked just one birth certificate out of the pack and chose that to be the number to align to change her birth certificate.
Thanks very much for the call, Ellen. I think if I'm going to take the liberty of kind of reframing the question, I mean, some of it sounds like this process of determining what is the legitimate birth certificate and what are the legitimate birth records also can be cumbersome, particularly if there's litigation involved, as there was in Ellen's case. Richard, is that the case?
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, when there was litigation involved, and then also at the mercy of kind of the vital records where it was at the county level, you know, the way that they had filed things and you know, redone numbers, mm-hmm. et cetera, there was just a lot of back and forth with the litigation, but then even after the litigation was settled and doing searches to find the record by what name they had it filed under, and that because the name had changed, they were yielding that there were no records on file, and it was just cumbersome, yes.
Yes. Richard, how common is that? Thanks very much for the call, Ellen.
Hi, John. It's pretty common. Adoption has evolved over the years. Back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, there weren't nearly so many formal processes, and record keeping was not as meticulous. Sometimes a family would just keep a baby for a friend for a while and end up adopting them. It's become more formalized and there's more information available, but in various states there have been issues with being able to match them properly, issues with where they're stored, preservation of records. That's part of what makes this urgent as well, is people who are reaching the point where they're having health issues, people who are reaching the point where they're dying, or siblings may be dying, or parents may be deceased. In my own story, I looked for 15 years to discover that both my birth parents had died before I was out of high school.
I am sorry to hear that. We've gotten a different question, a Facebook question from a listener named Lynn, which takes a slightly different slant on this, asks, you know, what do adoption attorneys think of this? Do they see it as an opportunity for more work or less work as a threat? Melissa, I'll start with you.
I think that adoption attorneys, you know, they're conducting searches as CIs in Indianapolis, as well as on the other end, they are performing adoptions as well. And I would say probably most of their business does not come from the confidential intermediary portion of it. But really, I think it's an ethical dilemma because, you know, you can just ask them how much are they making off the back end of this. So they're separating the families, they're sealing, they're having these adoptions, and the records are being sealed, and then 21 years later, the adoptee is going to them to conduct a search.
We are talking about opening up Indiana's adoption records here on No Limits. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Amy. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was calling in response to the woman who emailed anonymously about having been an anonymous, the offspring of an anonymous sperm donor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of two mothers to a child, and we used a known sperm donor. And I think that one thing that I think a lot of people aren't aware of is that there's an enormous financial, medical, and legal burden to families who do want to use a known donor to create their families. And that was something that my wife and I encountered and persevered through over the course of 2 years, because we were really committed to having our child know her genetic history. But there are a lot of barriers that families face, and they may not be as fortunate as we were.
How old is your child now?
She's 14 months.
Oh, congratulations. Those are good years.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Well, we should talk, because the hook really here is the legislation that's moving through the Indiana Senate. And it is moved through the Indiana Senate, 46-3
vote. 46-3.
Okay. It moves over to the House.
It does.
Now, what are the prospects there for passage, and who is carrying it? Who's carrying the bill on the House side?
As of right now, really, the House is not looking at bills from the Senate.
Have you gotten
a
commitment from someone to carry it over there yet?
Or? We have, yes. They have not been named yet, but we've gotten verbal commitments from three people. But the House isn't going to begin looking at these
until the bills cross over the session changes. Obviously, a 46-3 vote on the Senate side
very
has to
strong.
Be encouraging to you.
Yes.
Had it in the past, had you gotten to this point in the past where
Never.
It passed one chamber? Had it even made it to a vote on the floor before?
Right. In 2011, we brought this to the Senate committee, and it didn't even make it to a vote.
It didn't make it out of committee?
It did not.
Is that, Richard, in terms of where you've seen this process in other states around the country, Is Indiana moving quickly or moving more slowly than most?
Well, with respect to this bill, it was introduced, shot into committee, approved, and overwhelmingly passed by the Senate, which was very impressive. Many states have a longer struggle and debate around this, which I think speaks to the organization and the clear message that HERE has brought to the table. Many states, as Melissa said, though, it doesn't all just happen overnight. I know here in Colorado, we've worked on this issue incrementally for 20 years before the Senate and House both passed our bill unanimously. There's kind of a tipping point in terms of information that happens in many states where you're able to separate the emotional issues from the legal issues from the real-life practical issues. Legislators get kind of exhausted with listening to lots of emotional testimony, and when you can break it down to a simple message, it really can make a difference. I know one of the things...
we're getting a little tight on time, Richard, so...
Go ahead if you need to... Proceed.
Yeah, we need to wrap things up. I'd like to thank my guests, Melissa Shelton and Richard Erlob.
Thank you.
I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.